All right, so we'll be speaking today about the decrease in the rate of opioid analgesic-involved overdose deaths after the implementation of a multi-pronged public health strategy. So the public health approach to drug use surveillance, it really is to track drug use and its associated health consequences at the population level. It's to provide timely and accurate analysis of drug misuse indicators from multiple data sources, and I've listed them here, using all this data to really conduct data-driven initiatives, as well as provide rapid deployment of public health resources to high-priority areas, and ensure rigorous follow-up to ensure strategies are effective. Let me just give you some background about the presentation today. From 2000 to 2011, we saw that the rate of unintentional drug poisoning deaths involving opioid analgesics increased 435% in one county of New York City, Staten Island, from a rate of 2 per 100,000 residents to 10.7 per 100,000 residents. And specifically, during the time period from 2005 to 2011, that's where we saw where the disparities were widening between Staten Island and the other four New York City boroughs. In 2011, the rate in Staten Island was about over four times higher than the rate in the other New York City boroughs. We use this graphic here to really kickstart what we were doing around opioid analgesics specifically. Here I have a map. On your left, you'll see that the rates of opioid analgesic prescription for hydrocodone and or oxycodone by the different neighborhoods of New York City. And on the right, we have mapped the rates of unintentional drug poisoning deaths involving opioid analgesics. What is showing here is that the darkest regions are the same in both of these maps, and those are for Staten Island. Here we have the number in the blue bars and the rates per 100,000 residents. And we see for New York City overall that the rates increased 267% from 2000 with 59 deaths to 2011, 220 deaths. And here is that graphic that's displaying the borough differences. Again, with Staten Island, which is the blue line here, the rates really, really widening from 2005 and 2011 is where you see the rates at about four times higher than all the other New York City boroughs. We looked at our prescription monitoring program data, and we saw that Staten Island residents filled opioid analgesic prescriptions at the highest rates. And overall, New York City, you have there on the far left, and the other four boroughs in the middle. We looked at the indicator of median day supply, so the day supply for each prescription, and we saw that the prescriptions filled by Staten Islanders were actually longer than prescriptions filled by residents of other New York City boroughs. Their median day supply was 30 days, and then the other boroughs about 15. And then the metric of high dose prescriptions, this being prescriptions above 100 morphine milligram equivalents, prescriptions filled by Staten Island residents were also extremely higher than the other four residents of the other four boroughs and citywide. So in response to this public health crisis, we launched a five-part public health strategy, including citywide opioid prescribing guidelines. We published data briefs for local media, and this highlighted the Staten Island mortality and prescription data. We also convened a Staten Island town hall meeting with the former New York, with the health commissioner, Dr. Farley, and met with a few stakeholders there. We had the Staten Island campaign to promote prescribing guidelines, which was a public health detailing campaign. And then we had a few public service announcements with additional airing on Staten Island. So the objective of this study was really to assess the impact of a targeted multi-pronged public health strategy on the opioid analgesic prescribing patterns and our opioid analgesic involved mortality. So here are our methods for our mortality. We link our two data sources, death certificates and toxicology findings. So those who are familiar with the levels, which is a level four analysis, we restricted our data to unintentional drug poisoning overdose, determined as accidental. We use the following underlying or multiple cause codes, and in New York City, we have some coding issues with the F code, so that's what we have here. In terms of our PMP, our prescription monitoring program, we look specifically only at Schedule II opioid analgesics. We assess median day supply, rates per capita, as well as the high morphine milligram equivalent dose prescriptions per capita. For our mortality rates, we conducted rates for all drug-involved overdose deaths, heroin-involved, and opioid analgesic-involved deaths. We compared our rates during 2011 through 2013. All of our rates were age-adjusted, and we did rate change comparisons using Z-test and gamma interval distribution comparisons. So in terms of our public health response, these are opioid prescribing guidelines. These were recommended guidelines. They weren't mandatory. And some of the main ideas or guidelines were to prescribe less often, to prescribe at shorter duration. A three-day supply of an opioid analgesic prescription is usually sufficient. If you're going to prescribe an opioid analgesic, prescribe at a lower dose, because if doses reaching above 100 morphine milligram equivalents were associated with a higher risk for overdose, and to avoid prescribing opioid analgesics and benzodiazepines together. And these prescribing guidelines were well received by many prescribers. We adapted these prescribing guidelines for our emergency department, and this is an example of a poster that we supplied for our emergency departments, which they could put up. These were released in January 2013 and adopted by many of our emergency departments. For the Staten Island public detailing campaign, this took on the model that pharmaceutical companies use to, you know, detail doctors one-on-one, and these were one-on-one detailing visits with prescribers, really basically about the prescribing guidelines. We provided clinical tools and patient education materials. We reached out and met with about 1,000 physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants on Staten Island. We did this over a three-month period. And here is an example of one of the patient education tools. Providers were given this to put up in their offices, again with the targeted theme at the top. Overdoses from opioid painkillers kill more Staten Islanders than car accidents. In terms of our media campaign, we ran these across 3 years. The first one was in 2012, and this was to increase the awareness of opioid analgesic overdose. And the second campaign was really to reduce the stigma and raise awareness about opioid analgesic misuse. The second campaign took the form of testimonials, the first being a mother who had lost her son to an opioid analgesic overdose, and the second was a resident in recovery. And both of these testimonials were actually Staten Island residents. Now I'll go into our results. We were able to look at our change in prescriber knowledge. So in June, we met with our prescribers, and in August, we did our follow-up visits. And these are the recommendations that we educated our prescribers on. Well, the main message you want to take away here is that knowledge increased from baseline to follow-up across all of these indicators. The most significant finding that we thought was that the 100 morphine milligram equivalent dose, very low knowledge at initial visit among prescribers, only 22% of prescribers answering correctly. And then we saw that increase to almost 60% of providers. Here is our comparison of our Staten Island rates in blue compared to rates in all other boroughs of New York City, and we see that Staten Island opioid analgesic mortality actually decreased 29% from 2011 to 2013, and in the orange, we've highlighted the various strategies that we've conducted over time. When we look at our prescription data, we saw that the rate of opioid analgesic prescriptions actually decreased 10% in Staten Island. And here from left to right, we have the rates from 2011 to 2013. In New York City overall, you see very stable rates, slightly decreasing, as well as in the other four boroughs, slightly decreasing. Staten Island, that decrease is more pronounced. Here, we see that the rate of high-dose prescriptions, again, prescriptions that are above 100 morphine milligram equivalents, decreased 8% in Staten Island, while in the other boroughs, this increased about 5% from 2011 to 2013. And in terms of median day supply of prescriptions, while we did not see a change in median day supply for Staten Island prescriptions, we did see that in the other New York City boroughs and in New York City overall, the day supply actually increased. And here in this table, we've laid out the rates of overdose by drug type. And so the first half here, we have the Staten Island rates for any drug, heroin involved, and opioid analgesic involved. And on the bottom half, we have the rates among the other four boroughs. And we see that in Staten Island, the 29% decrease from 2011 to 2013 for the opioid analgesic involved overdose deaths, and no change for the deaths involving opioid analgesics in the other four boroughs. Here we have the comparison of the prescription changes, again with Staten Island at the top, highlighting the decrease in the high morphine equivalent dose prescriptions, about 8%, and then the increase in the other four boroughs at 5% from 2011 to 2013. So there are some limitations to this study. It is not known whether decedents took prescriptions prescribed to them or not prescribed to them, and nor at what dose. It's not possible then to really understand whether or not the decrease in the prescriptions available really contributed to that, or was it because of prescriptions being available for diversion. It did not measure law enforcement, the impact law enforcement had to decrease the supply of diverted opioids, and it was not possible to determine the extent of each intervention's contribution to the decline in the opioid analgesic overdose rates. However, we were able to show that data-driven and multi-pronged public health strategies contributed to a reduction in the rate of opioid analgesic-involved overdose deaths in Staten Island. Some of the implications, well, targeted public health interventions are effective in lowering opioid analgesic-involved overdose mortality rates and the rate of high-dose prescriptions. And this type of intervention, which we conducted in Staten Island, can be replicated by other health departments and jurisdictions. Again, focusing on opioid analgesics and, you know, at the supply side is what we tried to do as well. And some acknowledgments, our staff at the health department. And that was just an extra slide if you wanted to see it, but that was it. Thank you.
Reduction of Staten Island is still relatively high compared to the other boroughs. I mean, do you anticipate still continuing to focus on Staten Island? And what do you think the impact of kind of spillover effects are? Because I'm sure there's docs and others who, you know, I mean, you can't just limit your educational opportunities to Staten Island, and it seems like other people would become aware of it.
Yeah, and we are continuing to do, I mean, throughout the city, continuing to do things around opioid analgesics. For example, in the Bronx, which had the second highest rates of prescription filled, we're currently conducting another detailing campaign with prescribers. My colleague Jessica Catan in the audience can give more information about that. And then this was just one strategy that we're doing specifically around opioid analgesics. The health department, specifically our bureau, is strong supporters of naloxone. We fund a lot of the naloxone that comes out in New York City. In addition to the state, but in terms of the intranasal, we're the ones that supply that out to the community. We have contracts for treatment contracts, so we're doing a lot of things, but this is just one piece of that. So we're continuing to do things in Staten Island, but as well as in other places.
Great talk, thank you.
Thank you.
I was curious, to what extent is it possible to use provider names out of the prescription drug monitoring database to target outreach and detailing?
Well, we don't have, the New York State is the holder of PMP data. They provide New York City with a subset. So they de-identify, they clean that data up. We don't have any identified names, phone numbers, or anything like that. In terms of how we actually sampled prescribers, we have a list that we collapsed out of the health department through another bureau of primary care physicians, and so that was the way that we sampled. Correct, Jessica?
Actually, for Staten Island, that is correct, although it was even more broad. We tried to reach nearly every physician, PA, and nurse practitioner who's specialty was one that would be likely to prescribe it quickly. For example, we left out pathology, which would be routinely prescribed. And because Staten Island is the smallest borough in population, we actually could target nearly everybody.
I think this is a very interesting study, especially the evaluation component, everything, the baseline data that you collected, but also the measurement of the magnitude of your intervention on the rates of prescription and deaths as well. However, despite the statistical significance for some of your endpoints, I'm struck with the persistently high levels of prescription. And so I wonder whether obviously something much more directed needs to be done to changing the practices, especially in the emergency rooms, that tend to prescribe a lot of these medications. That would be something a little more targeted, much more directed to changing, as I say, the prevailing and the prevalent practice of giving a medication when at times that should not be the case. The second comment or question also that I would like to mention, what thoughts you might have on future work, it has to do with the natural history of opiate dependence, in that in my own experience, many individuals begin with prescription medications. They reach a level of tolerance whereby the medication is unable to give them the the stimulation that or address their dysphoric mood. And so they progress to more intense routes of opiate administration, such as smoking, heroin, or intravenous. So the fact that you were unable to document the decline in mortality may mean that actually you may be looking at a more long-term impact, and that while you may be impacting on those that are beginning to become dependent, those that are more entrenched are finding other ways and other routes, intravenous, for example, and still overdose from that.
We also have a qualitative unit that sits within our surveillance unit, and our qualitative team was able to go out to Staten Island and interview about 120 individuals, and they actually were able to describe three different populations of people who were using opioid analgesics. The first being young initiates, people who had initiated in high school, recreationally, medical initiates who had initiated through prescription, and the third being experienced opiate users, people who were using heroin previously and transitioned back and forth between opioid analgesics and heroin. And that population, our opioid population, we found about a third of individuals transitioned from opioid analgesics to heroin. And it was really the entrenched users who had transitioned. It was individuals who are on very, very high dose, who were snorting pills, and then transitioned to heroin. So, you know, like I said, about a third of that population. So there were people who were using recreationally who didn't transition. But of those who we did see transition, were people who are on very high dose prescriptions.
Very difficult to change providers' behavior around prescribing opioids because there really aren't a lot of other options, especially for Medicaid clients that may not have access to alternative strategies. So even though in the literature it's been shown that prescribing opiates for chronic pain doesn't really work in decreasing their long-term outcomes, there's not a lot of other options for pain. So, I mean, and the thing about ED physicians is that they do have a high volume of prescribing, but pretty low pill count. So, I think it's also the primary care providers that really have the bigger volume.
And I think, following up, if I could, on the ED point, I think We know from national data that, yes, ED providers certainly encounter pain a lot in the emergency department, but they actually account for a relatively smaller proportion of the volume of pills prescribed, and there's actually a larger percentage, like the top three are primary care, family medicine, and orthopedic surgeons by volume, because there's more of those physicians. And we actually did have an intervention, I know Washington did also, in the emergency departments, because we know they need support because they encounter this issue all the time. And both of the, and I think Melanie, you showed the poster, and both of the hospitals in Staten Island had adopted those guidelines, so definitely important to include support.
I was just wondering if any of the materials and stuff or anything was available to look at, just because this is something we've been working on as well, and
yeah,
would be interested to kind of build from that or reach out to you guys or something.
Yeah, we have a lot of information. Get your information after.
That's great.
Awesome. Yeah.
Any theory as to why the prescribing rates in Staten Island were accelerating so rapidly compared to your other boroughs?
I mean, I know that in the community of Staten Island is very insular, so I mean, if you're on Staten Island, you live there, and everybody knows each other, at least sort of that's what we were hearing in our qualitative too, like people that were getting prescriptions were people that they already, like their family friends or people that they knew, so maybe they were just...
As long as it's a bit higher than the boroughs, it has been common, but there came that inflection point in the rates, and that's what caught your attention.
Right.
I can't remember what year it was.
Yeah, 2005.
So any theories as to why that happened?
I mean, we didn't have any prescription monitoring program data back then, but from 2008, they definitely had the highest rates there as well. I mean, the only thing I could comment on is that it really is such an insular community there, and people were just be able to get prescriptions from people, go to family doctors or go to people that they knew, were able to just get them easier than if you were going to multiple prescribers. And in fact, when we looked at doctor shopping in New York City, going to multiple prescribers, for example, three or more, that didn't happen very often. It was only about less than 1% of the population in New York City were doctor shoppers. Yes.
You noticed that your stay was over 3 years, but also you ended up doing the targeted intervention, so to speak, with physicians for a few months during one of the years.
Mm-hmm.
The question that I have is, how do you know that that it wasn't only that the changes were only from the intervention and not other things that were going on in the community during that time period?
We don't know. I mean, we obviously had a lot of things going on, even at the end of August. I mean, we didn't have the slide here. We did break it down by various quarters here. We compared October 2013 because basically that intervention happened from June to August, and so we wanted to compare sort of what happened in the latter half of the quarters, and we compared that across all three years, from 2011, 12, and 13. So trying to see whether or not that difference was sustained across, was it similar to time periods in the previous years.
So you did the intervention, and then you looked at the change of behavior. You looked at the change as far as knowledge, but then did you follow up and look at their? I mean, you made the assumption that behavior changed because rates fell, but did you follow up with any of those physicians, nurse practitioners, et cetera, to see how long that education was sustained during that time period?
Not individually, no. Yes.
Your licensing procedures, because I live in Utah, and as a clinician, now everybody's required to do education on this to keep your license. I mean, you basically have to do required PME on it, and they send it to you, maybe so you do it. And then the other thing is they have a database that allows you to look up any individual patient to see if they've been prescribed opioids or somebody else who can do that.
We
so those kind of interventions that are more structural around licensing.
Right, and in 2013, well, it was passed in 2012, a New York State law, ISTOP, which mandated prescriber lookup in the prescription monitoring program. It required, when they were prescribing narcotic prescriptions, any narcotic prescriptions required lookup, as well as lookup was allowed for pharmacists. So mandatory, and that actually came into effect in August of 2013.
Mandatory PME that physicians get every year. I mean, I get it now every year. that I have to do, like it's 4 to 7 hours or something, CME and the booklet that you have to, and it's the same thing.
Jessica, do you know, you can comment on that?
Yeah, that's currently a conversation at the state level right now, but it's not implemented now. I think there's only 2 other CME topics required for licensure at this point.
There's a bill in the legislature. I'm not sure where it stands right now. It's in both the Assembly and the Senate.
Thank you.